There are reports today that President-elect Donald Trump has nominated retired Marine General John F. Kelly to be his Secretary of Homeland Security. And earlier today, reports that Trump will put forward Iowa's Republican Governor Terry Branstad to be his ambassador to China. Branstad says he's a longtime friend of Chinese President Xi Jinping. They bonded over agricultural issues. And that may help smooth over Trump's relationship with a country he's been taking shots at for months, most recently in his phone call with Taiwan's president, which offended China's demand for one China. And in his weekend tweets, they read things like, "Did China ask us about devaluing currency? I don't think so." This morning, the Today Show's Matt Lauer asked Trump if he's using Twitter responsibly.
I talk about important things. I talked about, you know, as you know, recently China and the fact we talked about their devaluation. We talked about their building this massive military fortress in the middle of the South China Sea, which they're not supposed to be doing, and other things.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving joins us. Ron, start with Trump's tweeting, you know, chastising Chinese policy publicly. Will Governor Branstad be able to smooth that out?
Governor Branstad is going to have a rather tall order in interpreting Donald Trump and his tweets to the Chinese. He is probably the ideal candidate to do it because he has a great deal of personal trust with Donald Trump. He stood by Donald Trump throughout the fall campaign. Even when there was a great deal of controversy, he was steadfast. And his son, Eric, was actually in charge of the Trump campaign in Iowa. So there is a good relationship between the two men. They're the same age. They see much of the world in similar terms. And then, of course, the relationship that you pointed out between Terry Branstad and the Chinese president, which is also enormously valuable. So if anyone can bridge this gap, which is clearly going to be a serious gap between what Donald Trump may say in one instance and then what he may tweet in the next morning, Terry Branstad would seem to be the ideal candidate.
Well, talking about that relationship that he has with the Chinese president, here's an interview Branstad did with CNN about the Chinese president visiting Iowa in the 1980s.
He was so pleased with the warm and friendly welcome he received, and he really considers Iowans his old friend.
So somebody with, you know, relations with the country. But what more does it say to you about how the Trump administration might deal with Beijing?
I think we need to get accustomed to the idea of zig and zag, so that on the one hand, we have the phone call with the Taiwanese president, which is a phone call that would be unacknowledged over the last four decades. But this, of course, was set up by Bob Dole, the former Senate Majority Leader, one-time Republican nominee for president. He's now a lobbyist with Alston and Byrd, and he set up that telephone call. And they have an arrangement going forward where he's representing Taiwanese interests. And he was, of course, the only previous Republican nominee for president, or president for that matter, who actually endorsed Donald Trump. And he was there at the convention in Cleveland. So all of that is coming home to roost. And Bob Dole is doing rather well for himself. That's one version. And then we have, on the other hand, the Terry Branstad friendship going the other way with mainland China.
Well, what do you make of that? Bob Dole reportedly negotiating so that a Taiwanese delegation came to the Republican convention, spending months as a part of a negotiation to get this phone call, which when it first hit the news, we heard was just, oh, just kind of like came out of the blue. It didn't. It was planned. And we have a Donald Trump who said he's going to get rid of the lobbyists and the call planned by lobbyist Bob Dole. What do we make of this?
Well, but there is no chance that there will be no lobbyists in Washington, D.C. When people talk about getting rid of the lobbyists, they usually mean getting rid of the lobbyists who have been successful in the last administration and listening to a different group of people. Anyone who tries to get Washington to do anything, either through Congress or the executive branch, is lobbying. That's the definition. And whether you actually register as one or not is just a fine point of the law. There are clearly going to be influential people in any administration. And Bob Dole has been interested in Taiwanese issues back to the 1970s, way back when he was a young senator.
Just briefly, why?
Just because he had gotten interested in the struggles between the different forces in China way back to World War II. Bob Dole is a World War II veteran and still sees the world much in the kind of terms that people did in the first half of the 20th century and in the middle part of the 20th century.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. You know, will surprises ever stop here? Who would have thought that Bob Dole would emerge as a player in Washington again?
At the age of 93.
Right. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, 29 states and D.C. have considered laws this year that would automatically register their citizens to vote. The laws are designed to boost voter turnout, and six states have already passed them. For more, we're joined by Dan DiOrio, a policy specialist with the National Conference of State Legislatures. Dan, welcome, and explain the term here. How does automatic voter registration work?
Well, automatic voter registration means that a state will now automatically register a voter. So at the point when a voter goes into a DMV and they go to either get a new driver's license or a new ID card or update a driver's license, the state will automatically register them to vote. So they will be instantly added to the voter rolls unless they decide to opt out of that process.
And last month, Alaska became the sixth state to approve automatic voter registration, but there are a number of efforts underway around the country. Why do you think we're seeing this wave of automatic voter registration bills right now?
Well, I think automatic voter registration is becoming the next big ticket item as far as voting rights are concerned in the U.S. And I think folks are looking at it as a way to get over that first barrier to getting folks actually out and voting and involved in the electoral process. Oftentimes, registration is that first step, that first barrier that folks have a hard time figuring out. Or if they move a lot, it's not often that they remember that their registration doesn't come with them and that they have to re-register when they vote. So by getting rid of that first barrier, advocates are hoping to have more folks turning out to vote.
Is there any evidence that turnout has gone up in places where they have automatic voter registration?
Well, right now, I think the evidence is inconclusive. There's only one state in the country that's actually implemented automatic voter registration, and that's Oregon. They registered 250,000 new voters through their automatic voter registration system, which they're calling their new motor voter. And turnout for those voters was at about 43% in the November election, which was higher than they anticipated.
How big is the pool of eligible but unregistered voters that measures like these are trying to reach?
Well, certainly for some states, it could be well in the millions. A state like California, there could be several million eligible voters that are not registered. So depending on the state, it can be quite a bit.
Now, most of the states where bills like this have passed lean Democratic, and many of the bills introduced in conservative states have been proposed by Democrats. In fact, just last week we saw in Illinois that an effort to override the governor's veto on one of these bills failed. That was done by Democrats in the legislature. But the exception is West Virginia. What's happened there?
Well, West Virginia was a really unusual case, and I think a great case of bipartisan compromise. Republicans in the legislature there, they control both chambers of the legislature in West Virginia, were debating a voter ID requirement. And along the way, Democrats proposed adding to that an automatic voter registration system. And Republicans decided not to object and to allow it through. They felt as though it was a natural step to go along with voter ID, and that West Virginia being the state it is, oftentimes folks would go to a DMV and they would probably know someone that worked there. So they thought it was a great compromise.
So why do you think that it has split among partisan lines, that Democrats seem to want automatic voter registration and Republicans don't?
Well, I think certainly you have some concerns on the Republican side that voters who may not be eligible are going to be somehow swept up in this system. And I think that's a legitimate concern that states need to iron out before going forward with an automatic voter registration system. And I also think that you have the typical First Amendment constitutional concern, which is whether or not the government should be forcing someone to register to vote, even if they may not want to. Switching that burden from an opt-in system to now the burden is on the voter to opt out.
And there would never be a federal effort to get automatic voter registration across the country, right? Because this would have to be done by the states.
I think it's highly unlikely. We have a decentralized election system in this country. That means we have 51 different election systems, 51 different sets of voting requirements. And so I think it's highly unlikely that we'll get something at the federal level.
Meanwhile, there is an effort on the other side of things to make voting a little more restrictive using things like voter ID laws. I know that there's one being considered in Michigan that would require you to show a photo ID within 10 days of election day. Otherwise, your vote doesn't count. What about the efforts there? Tell us about what's going on across the country to make voting more restrictive.
Well, I think certainly voter ID has been an issue in state legislatures since about 2010. It was a very large issue in 2010, 2011, 2012, but it has since dropped off a little bit. But it's one of those perennial issues that will always be around. I think states will continuously look at voter ID requirements and ways to ensure that it's easy to vote in that state but hard to cheat. And I always caution folks, because we are a decentralized system and we have 51 different sets of requirements, it can be difficult to compare apples to apples across states and really determine which states may be restrictive, which states may be open.
That's Dan DiIorio, who's a policy specialist with the National Conference of State Legislatures. Dan, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Even before the election, Donald Trump's rise to power had been compared, either subtly or overtly, to Adolf Hitler's rise in 1930s Germany. But are those comparisons fair or just hyperbolic? Joining us now is Daniel Ziblatt, a professor of government at Harvard University and author of the forthcoming book, Conservative Parties and the Birth of Modern Democracy in Europe. And Daniel, before we get to talking about some of these comparisons that people are making, I want to just go back and talk about the rise of Hitler and how he came to power. First of all, remind us about the economic and political climate in Germany back at that moment.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of really important conditions that gave rise to the emergence of Hitler as a political leader, then also how he took power. One of the key things that one has to keep in mind is that Germany had just lost the war. World War One,
right.
And millions of people had died, and, you know, 4% of the population, I mean, way beyond anything the United States experienced. So there was a kind of sense of trauma in the population. And then this coupled with the economic crisis that came several years later, these are the conditions under which these kind of appeals that Hitler made really found mass following.
And the economic crisis that you're talking about made worse by the fact that the U.S. stopped investing in Germany.
Yeah, so the Great Depression came in 1929, and so this was a serious economic shock. But I think one of the things that's also important to keep in mind is that the rise of Hitler wasn't driven just by war and economics. There was a kind of set of political preconditions, and in a way, the immune system of the German political system was already lowered, I would argue, before 1929.
What do you mean by that?
So two main things, I think. One, there had been a kind of long-term decay in the main conservative party in Germany. So the kind of Tory conservative party, it was a kind of constitutional center-right party, ambivalent about democracy, had kind of played the democratic game in the mid-1920s. But by the end of the 1920s, had radicalized and kind of fallen apart. And this created an opening on the right.
And Hitler took advantage of that opening. How and when did he appear on the scene?
Well, he was initially on the scene kind of as a rabble-rouser in Munich in the early 1920s, had been arrested at the Beer Hall Putsch, had written his memoirs, Mein Kampf, but in some sense was a kind of marginal character, and his political party was marginal. And we sometimes forget that the Weimar system was actually dominated by the Social Democratic Party with full democratic credentials throughout this period. So in some ways, the political system looked to be very booming at some level in the early 20s. And it was really only after the collapse of this center-right party in 1928 and then the Great Depression, 1929, that Hitler really began to have his breakthroughs in 1930, 1932.
And was there something about his personality that people were attracted to in those early days?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was both his personality as well as his movement. And he was, the classic demagogue and was able to play to the audience and to kind of adjust his message based on what the audience wanted. So certainly that was a big part of it. But I really think that a key part of the story was there was an opportunity there with the kind of vacuum on the right side of the political spectrum combined with the economic crisis and the kind of trauma of war created an opportunity for somebody like him to come along.
And he didn't come to power railing against Jews, right?
This was part of his appeal. I mean, there's no question that he was an anti-Semite, and it was very clear from the outset. But this was only one part of the kind of appeals that he was making. He was also making appeals about nationalism, restoring Germany's position in the international system. And so it was a kind of nationalist appeal as well as an economic appeal.
So he was appointed chancellor by the president, Paul von Hindenburg, in 1933. And then in 1934, Hindenburg died, and there were no new elections. Why not?
Yeah. So really, I mean, I think the way he came to power in some ways contains some of the most instructive lessons for us today when we look back. he was included in the initial coalition in the cabinet in 1933 by Hindenburg, although President Hindenburg despised him and really looked down upon him. He was a kind of corporal, and Hindenburg was a general. And he included him very much kind of opportunistically with the idea, well, we'll keep him contained, we'll control him, and this is the only way to kind of put the right in power. The right had fallen apart, as I was saying before 1933, and so the only way to kind of keep the Social Democrats out of power was to place him in power. And once Hitler was in power after January 1933, I mean, I think the game was basically up. I mean, it was a kind of slow process of squeezing German democracy until by the end of 1933, it was really no longer in existence.
Well, one of the things that was done that a lot of people look back on as a key moment was the burning of the Reichstag, the parliament building, which was blamed on a young communist. Is there historical consensus about whether that was completely false?
Yeah, and I think most people think that that was, in fact, a kind of forged event. I mean, that this was an event created for the political benefit of the Nazi Party to consolidate power.
And how did they consolidate power right after that?
There was a kind of general slow-term squeeze on the freedom of press was restricted. The ability of parties to kind of show up in the parliament was restricted. The Nazis would show up in parliament in their uniforms and gradually just made the political environment so that it was essentially no longer a functioning democracy.
Okay. So we've heard a little bit about the rise of Hitler there. So let's talk about these comparisons that some people are making, some very overtly, some more subtly, between Hitler and Trump. Do you think that there's anything there?
Yes, yeah, certainly the comparison's in some sense very inflammatory. So one has to really work, as one thinks about this, in a very careful way. And I think the first thing to do is to think about the differences, because there are substantial differences. Number one, as I've said, that the kind of wartime trauma is something that Germany experienced in 1918 that the U.S. didn't experience then and certainly is not experiencing now. The second major difference, I would say, was that the U.S. is a much older democracy in a much older country than Germany was in 1920s, 1930s. I mean, we know, of course, that Germany was a new democracy in 1918, but we sometimes forget that Germany was actually a relatively new country, only being founded in 1871, so 50 years earlier. It was really a brand new country. So in this sense, I think American democracy is certainly more robust than German democracy was at that point. And then a third big difference that I think, you know, we just have to put on the table is that the kind of nature and the scale of the challenge was greater. I mean, in some sense, Adolf Hitler and fascism in general was a kind of very coherent attempt to overturn democratic political systems. Populists today, I think Donald Trump counts as a populist along with Marine Le Pen in France and the UKIP party in Great Britain. And these are all populist movements.
And the difference between populist and fascist is what?
I think that populists in some sense kind of represent a kind of low-grade fever of democracy in the sense that there's a kind of latent problem in democracy. And this can sometimes break out and be a serious crisis of democracy. But there's no real effort to overturn democracy by contemporary populists. So in that sense, the challenge is not as significant. That being said, I think there are some real similarities that one should point to, though.
Well, and let's listen to a little bit of Donald Trump and the things that have alarmed people and made them make these comparisons.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. I alone can fix it. I will restore law and order to our country.
We're going to open up those libel laws so that when the New York Times writes a hit piece, which is a total disgrace, or when the Washington Post, which is there for other reasons, writes a hit piece, we can sue them and win money instead of having no chance of winning because they're totally protected.
We will make America strong again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
So you hear they're going after a group of immigrants in this country, sort of attacks on freedom of the press, nationalism. What do you hear there, and do you see why some people hear that and make this comparison?
Yeah, again, I mean, there are striking similarities in the kind of language that populists and fascists use, but I think it's important to distinguish the two in the sense that although, you know, there's a participation in democratic elections, a willing up for populists, a willingness to accept the results of elections, but kind of playing with this issue, so it's dangerous. So there are similarities. And I just would emphasize two main points, I guess. One, that in both instances, in both Weimar Germany and today, I think the rise of this kind of right-wing populism emerges as conservative parties fall apart. And so there's a kind of sometimes a kind of fantasy of maybe social democrats and liberals that as conservative parties fall apart, this will mean triumph for social democracy and liberal parties. But in fact, what happens when conservatism falls apart is you get this kind of language, you get this kind of movement, and you get this kind of politics. The second point is that all of this is a response to a perceived dysfunction in the political system. And so this is another kind of commonality, I guess, both in Weimar Germany and the United States. I mean, so there's a kind of long-term slow decay often people point to in the American political system, congressional dysfunction, the rise of executive orders, and there's a kind of perception that a single individual needs to step in to kind of solve problems. And so I think institutional dysfunction, both in the Weimar system, where one also found this, and today, gives rise to kind of this temptation to have a single leader solve all of our problems for us.
In terms of comparing a U.S. politician to Hitler, this is not new. This is something that has happened. We remember it with George W. Bush and with Barack Obama. There were those posters of him with a Hitler mustache. On the one hand, you think it's very dangerous to make that comparison because Hitler was so uniquely bad. On the other hand, some people would say, well, you don't want to miss the comparisons if there are comparisons because once you do, it's too late.
Yeah, no, this is exactly the dilemma that somebody like myself faces. So I've been writing a book on conservative parties throughout history. And I guess that the way I think about this is that conservatism itself in some ways contains a dilemma, which is that it can sometimes degenerate into right-wing populism. The form that the right-wing populism takes varies, certainly. And in some instances, it can kind of veer out of control into a kind of fascism that is much more dangerous. In the contemporary setting of the United States and Western Europe, we're not facing that kind of challenge, but we are seeing the same dynamic in the sense that we're seeing conservative parties degenerating, declining appeal, declining organization, and this kind of populism pops up in its wake. And so being alert to the differences as well as the similarities is, I think, really something very important for all of us to do.
Daniel Ziblatt is a professor of government at Harvard University who studies Weimar Germany. Daniel Ziblatt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
75 years ago today, Japan attacked the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, killing more than 2,300, propelling the U.S. into World War II. December 7th brings back memories for many, including people in Hawaii. Molly Solomon from Hawaii Public Radio reports.
It was a morning Charles Black would never forget, as he recalled driving to the exact spot where he was 75 years ago.
So I'm going to come down here where you can see the view, because this right here is where we were sitting.
It was a Sunday, and a neighbor called to say they were under attack. So he raced from his house in the Tantalus Mountains to a one-lane road along the ridge. Amid the lush trees on the mountainside, Black's fears were confirmed.
From the water and on the other side of it was nothing but smoke. And we could see planes diving down on this end and some of them coming back up again, explosions. And a lot of smoke and a lot of fire.
Black, then 6 years old, remembers his neighbors crouching behind a stone wall. But he and his brother stood in disbelief, peering down at the destruction. Suddenly, several Japanese planes turned back toward the mountains. They flew so close, he and the pilots looked at each other.
We could see the rising sun on the wings. The lead plane, the cockpit, was slid back. And it was less than 100 feet above us. It was really close. Could see the pilot with his leather helmet, and this is just emblazoned in my mind, leather helmet with the flaps turned up, looking at us as they went right over the top of us.
Black wasn't the only one watching planes fly overhead. Milton Hironaka saw them as he was walking to church with his parents. He figured it was just another military drill.
We thought the U.S. Air Force was training, because prior to the attack, they used to fly over the city, and they used to have a simulated interception.
Hironaka, who was 4 years old at the time, remembers his parents were scared about the bombing and fearful because they were Japanese. He says after the attack, military police rounded up families in his neighborhood and sent them to internment camps on the U.S. mainland.
And my parents were really afraid, you know, they being Japanese, they were worried and concerned because now the United States were fighting against their homeland.
Anyone on Hawaii at the time had their own story. For Barbara Del Piano, news of the attack came as her family was gathering for waffles after church. A neighbor called and told them to turn on the radio.
And the voice of the announcer was saying, "The island of Oahu is under attack. Everybody take cover. The island of Oahu is under attack. The Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor." Over and over, he repeated those words, which are etched in my memory forever.
Del Piano and her family hauled mattresses into the living room and spent the rest of the night huddled around the radio. The next morning, Del Piano, who was 12 at the time, woke up to a different Hawaii.
Everything changed after that. Never again was Hawaii the same. It was so sad to see our casual, easy way of living disappear overnight.
Schools were closed, mail was censored, and food and fuel were rationed as Hawaii was put under martial law. Del Piano, now 87, says these events forever changed her life. And as painful as they are, she knows it's important to remember. For NPR News, I'm Molly Solomon in Honolulu.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Grady Kirkpatrick is program director at Wyoming Public Media. He's also a music host at Wyoming Sounds, which is a new music station from Wyoming Public Media. He joins us from Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Grady.
Hello. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing well and looking forward to hearing all of these pieces of music from Wyoming that you have brought us today, a range of Wyoming artists. And let's get right to the first one. This is Luke Bell, who's from Cody, and this is called All Blue.
All blue, Lord, all blue. I'm all blue and I can't say the reasons that I feel this way. But I gotta go home, Lord, I can't stay. Well, I got me some $2 shoes and a dusted down coat that fits all right. I'm bound to wander through the tall grass and find the biggest skies I can find. Lord, I can find.
Sounds kind of like Johnny Cash with a lot of coffee, right? An upbeat Johnny Cash. But tell us more about this one.
He's actually a former ranch hand and fifth generation descendant of Wyoming homesteaders, so he knows a little bit about the cowboy life. Rolling Stone magazine shows Luke Bell in the top 10 country artists you need to know in 2016. He's toured cross country. He got to play Bonnaroo in Tennessee last summer. And what I really like about Luke is I can segue his songs next to any of the greats like Johnny Cash, like you mentioned, Jimmy Rogers, Hank Williams, Bob Wills. Really a big voice, fine songwriter, and he can yodel.
And does a lot of the music that you're seeing coming out of Wyoming right now have that cowboy style, or is that pretty unique?
Not necessarily. Luke Bell is one of the better we've heard recently. There's a fair amount of roots rock, but in one of the songs we're going to hear, it's nothing close to that.
Well, let's get to another one. This is the Patty Fiasco. That's the name of the group. The song is Saved by Rock and Roll.
She had a
very different than the first one. Describe this one for us.
Yeah, and actually there's no one in the band named Patty. I'm not sure where that came from. It could have been a sour relationship. Who knows? Anyway, the band is fronted by Alicia Kraft. She's from a little town west of here called Encampment, and members of the group also have roots in Wyoming. They're now based in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Alicia spends a fair amount of time in Austin in the winter, but she's a very dynamic, high-energy performer, a bit sassy. She's been known to whip crowds into a frenzy, and the band delivers straight up rock and roll, part soul, funk, rockabilly, country, blues, and some of her songs reflect the experience of small towns and wide open spaces.
Well, and I imagine that Wyoming can be a great place for an artist to be because, first of all, probably not that expensive for them to live in certain places, but also you do have those beautiful expanses to inspire you.
Without a doubt. And some of these folks still are here, and some actually have moved to larger cities outside so they can make a little better living. But there is a good scene here.
Well, next we have the group J. Shogren Shanghai. This is Audubon's Birds of America.
High above the pines, I save my nickels, I save my dimes. Saved all winter until I could find Audubon's Birds of America. Audubon's Birds of America. The same way for a man to live.
Now, you've said that this style connects back to Wyoming's mountain man scene. What is that?
Yeah, Jay actually worked as a trapper in the tradition of the mountain man back in the 1800s. The style, it's a little hard to describe. He calls it Catawampus American music, and to be more specific, I suppose, a bit of Rocky Mountain High lonesome roots, folk, and blues. He's lived in Wyoming for quite some time. He has roots in Sweden and the Norse country and lives in a little town west of here called Centennial, population 270 with four bars. He's got a very interesting day job, too, as a professor of economics and finance at the University of Wyoming. He once worked with the King of Sweden and was party to the Nobel Peace Prize with former Vice President Al Gore.
And now he's making music in Wyoming.
Yeah, great storyteller, quite the literate songwriter, and he makes very good use of humor, occasionally on the dark side. And there really does seem to be a certain immediacy and urgency in his songs.
Okay, well, up next, I don't know if we have a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but we do have the Jackson, Wyoming group Sneaky Pete and the Secret Weapons. This song is called Forgotten Lullabies.
While I dream in Technicolor, city tea, you dance with my pen, exposing my very prose with a clarity I may never see again.
Kind of a fish sound there.
A little bit of the jam band. They've got funk, jazz. They like to call their style high-altitude stink funk. They formed in late 2011. They are Wyoming's premier funk band. They also do a fair amount of improv. It's a five-piece group. Includes organ, trumpet, great percussion, along with guitar and bass. The songs really do have an infectious groove. When they play live, the dance floor usually fills up, and they've toured extensively throughout the West and have a new record out. It's called Dojo. It's their second full release.
And when they say high-altitude stink funk, why the stink?
It's nasty.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a fun group. They put on a good show, and they get people moving.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and this is another group from Jackson. This is Canyon Kids. The song is Out Where the West Begins.
Out where the sun's a little brighter, where the snows that fall are a trifle whiter, where the bonds of home are a wee bit tighter, that's where the West begins. Out where the skies are a trifle bluer, how are the friendships a little truer? That's where the West begins.
Who are Canyon Kids?
Canyon Kids are Bo Ellidge and Dusty Nichols, and if those names aren't Western enough, another member's name is John Wayne Harris Jr. They're actually a musical collective, a collaboration, so to speak. On the recording we heard, they have a total of 17 musicians that participated in the recording at Teton Art Lab in Jackson Hole, and the song Out Where the West Begins was actually a poem from 1910 written by Arthur Chapman. So they took a number of poems on this release. They have a couple of originals, but set it to music.
Now, in all of these songs that we've heard today, in all of these genres, what do you think makes them Wyoming?
I think it's the sense of place is reflected a bit in the lyrics and a little bit of the style of the music. Certainly the wide open spaces, as you've mentioned, gives a bit of a grandeur to it, especially on that last one, and some of the other tunes certainly as well. But the thing about Canyon Kids that I didn't mention, they were working basically as photographers shooting rafting photos in the Snake River Canyon, and they had time to kill, and they ended up writing and rehearsing songs together. So it brought them together in a way that may not have happened elsewhere.
That's Grady Kirkpatrick, who is program director at Wyoming Public Media and also a music host at Wyoming Sounds, which is their new music station. Grady, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify, search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
The U.S. and five other Western countries are calling today for a ceasefire in Aleppo, Syria, but it may be too late. Syrian forces are said to be close to seizing that city back from rebel forces. Dr. Khaled Amalaji is watching closely. He was born in Aleppo, became a doctor in 2006, was imprisoned in the early years of the conflict for giving medical care to anti-government protesters. He says he was tortured in prison and after release risked his life going back and forth into rebel territory to work in a clinic. He's now at Brown University in Rhode Island, part of a stand by that school to bring Syrian refugees in to study. He joins us in the studio. And doctor, you are still trying to get aid to your countrymen, but seeing TV pictures, how do you remain positive?
Yeah, at the end, if I will be pessimistic, I will be in a horrible situation because a lot of people inside depend on us to keep working.
So you feel you can't be pessimistic?
I can. And all the doctors, they are saying, we will keep working, we will keep treat patients. Otherwise, we cannot allow that people just surrender and stop seeking democracy because they don't have food, because they don't have a hospital to go to. And actually, every time I go inside Syria, I feel more optimistic because you look at the people and you see how much they are optimistic and how much they feel happy because they are away from this regime.
Yeah. Well, but we know there's a Western Aleppo, which is more government-controlled, Eastern Aleppo, where there are thousands of civilians. They've been trying to get out, but thousands of civilians under this bombardment and also blockade. They have no food and no medicine. This has to be painful for you to see.
Yeah, actually, I've been in one of the neighborhoods which are now under heavy attacks, like running a small clinic. Now it's the life is like from the morning till the late evening, continuous bombardment with everything you can imagine, rockets, barrel bombs.
Well, and the most compelling pictures are, you know, the little boy sitting covered with rubble dust on all by himself in an ambulance, or men, the white helmets, the rescuers, running with these little limp bodies in their hands. I mean, as a physician, this has to be terrible to see.
Yeah, we received a lot of calls now from the white helmets group inside Aleppo that they are running out of fuel, running out of all their consumables and resources that they were using to take people out of the rubbles. Mm-hmm. So the bodies are filling the streets now.
Yeah.
So
it's being called a hell.
Yep.
Now, look, I know that from stateside, from here, you're trying to build more underground hospitals. But what else are you looking forward to? Because it feels now as if, especially with President-elect Donald Trump, who has indicated that he agrees with Russia and he might pull American support of opposition fighters, because the real fight is against ISIS. Opposition groups are also fighting ISIS. What does that mean for you?
As humanitarians, we have to say that we have to support civilians, whatever. We have to support civilians under ISIS control. We have to support civilians under the regime control. But the point is, the needs are different. In the rebels' areas, we cannot function there because all the civilian services, it's attacked by the air forces, and obviously it's the Russian and the Syrian regime. And in ISIS areas, civilians are actually more safe. Why? Because it's not attacked at all by the Syrian and the Russian regime.
Because Syrians know what many have suspected, that the Russians are not attacking ISIS, they're just attacking the opposition.
No, this is since 2.5 years. The regime was attacking Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor at that time. And when ISIS controlled those areas, zero attack on those areas.
Yeah. So Donald Trump did say on the campaign trail, he'd bomb the heck out of ISIS in Syria. You're shaking your head. Are you saying that you feel maybe things might be better under a Donald Trump?
Actually, all of us, including the president-elect, he will know more after he now.
After he's in office,
yes.
Yeah.
I think he was busy, but now he knows more who Russia is targeting in Syria.
Some would say this is wishful thinking on your part. You're wishing that Donald Trump will come around to seeing perhaps the rebels should be supported and that Russia is not attacking ISIS the way it is, saying it is.
I can say that he have a lot of pressure that he can do to stop the war. And in the end, it's not Donald Trump. It's the U.S. and the history who is writing what have been done so far by the greatest power in the world.
Look, you know what Donald Trump said during the campaign, that Syrian refugees should not be allowed in unless they're incredibly well vetted. We know and have reported on the fact that they are. Do you fear you might be thrown out?
Actually, for me, I'm not a refugee. I'm on a student visa here.
Yeah.
But again, if we are talking about the refugee crisis, it will never be solved by taking more and more refugees in Europe or in the U.S. or in Canada or anywhere.
It has to be fixed in Syria.
It's like a disease. You cannot fix a cancer by giving a Tylenol. You have to go and fix the disease itself.
That's Dr. Khaled Al-Malaji, a Syrian doctor who is currently at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, part of a program there. Dr. Al-Malaji, we wish you well. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.